You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Unless you're a serious movie buff, there's a good chance you've never heard of Lyle Talbot. But he starred with Barbara Stanwyck, Betty Davis, and even Shirley Temple in many Warner Brothers pictures before he moved to Broadway and television to further pursue his acting career. His personal story parallels the history of show business in America from the 20s through the 60s, and his daughter Margaret Talbot tells it in her new book, The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century, a look at how the life of one man can reflect the shifting landscape of show business in America. Ms. Talbot is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and her book is published by Riverhead. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hello.
Hi there.
Why did you start this book about your father by saying, I'm not a daddy's girl?
Well, because I didn't want to make it like too much of a case of special pleading. What interested me about my dad's story, or what made me feel that it could be an interesting book, was the fact that he was this sort of Zelig-like character who shows up at all these moments in entertainment history, never a star himself, never a big star. But in a way, that's what allowed me to tell a bigger story about entertainment history through him.
But he did star in films, but they're usually B-movies.
He did. Well, yes. I mean, he had, you know, his moment of being the young man who was being groomed for stardom at Warner Brothers. People said, oh, he's the next Clark Gable. And he was in, as you said.
And they predicted he and Katharine Hepburn would be the stars of the future.
Exactly. But it didn't happen.
But he did wind up appearing in a lot of movies as either the star or character actor. Playing supporting roles as a cowboy, a pirate, a detective, a cop, a surgeon, a psychiatrist, a soldier, a judge, a newspaper editor, a storekeeper, a boxer. Did he ever turn down a role?
No. that was something he came eventually to pride himself on. This is really a story about a working actor, somebody who manages to stay in a creative field and in Hollywood, cutthroat world, and make a living and love it and learn to feel proud and lucky that he never had to do any other kind of work, never had to sell real estate, never had to wait tables, and never turned down a role.
But it did lead him to appearing in three movies by Ed Wood.
That's right. That was a low point.
Glenda. Plan 9 from Outer Space has been called by some critics the worst movie ever made.
That's right. I think it won the Golden Turkey Awards that were given by Michael Medved. That was what sort of first brought it back into the spotlight a little bit. And then there was the Tim Burton movie with Johnny Depp about Ed Wood. Now Ed Wood has this kind of perverse, ironic hipster following. But my dad didn't really talk about the movies for a long time. I mean, I think they embarrassed him. But a job's a job, and he did the best he could. He brings a little dignity to the proceedings in the movies, I think.
Well, he was also a professional. How old was he when you were born?
He was 60. So I was a late in life baby.
The youngest child of your father's fifth marriage?
That's right. That was a surprise to me. My parents actually had a very long and happy marriage against all odds. My mother was 26 years younger, and it turns out to have been his fifth marriage. My siblings and I were a little vague on how many times he'd actually been married before. He was a little vague about it. But as I looked into this book, I discovered, yes, my mother was number five. The other marriages were brief compared to my parents' marriage.
Anyone whose name I might recognize?
No, I don't think so. Although he had a lot of one woman who was a very interesting character herself who went on to marry Henry Miller, the writer, and live in Big Sur as a sort of bohemian type. And then a woman named Tommy Adams, who was the girlfriend of George Jessel and kind of a notorious L.A. party girl.
He dated Sam Warner's widow, Lena Basquette.
That's right, who was herself quite a piece of work. Yes, and also...
Did that cause trouble for him?
It did. I mean, you know, she had had a child with one of the Warner Brothers, and she was not Jewish, and she was a showgirl, and the family didn't particularly approve of her, and in fact ended up taking their child to raise. And my father dated her after that, and he felt at times that the Warner Brothers, where he was still under contract at that time, were not too happy about that. But that may or may not have been the case. I'm not sure.
Well, they were often unhappy with things your father did. We'll get to some of them. But growing up with a much older father, he's 60 when you're born, so by the time you can talk to him, he's even older. Did he tell you as a 10-year-old about his adventures in Hollywood?
He did tell a lot of stories, and that, in fact, is one of the things that inspired me to do this book. I mean, he told stories about, you know, working with Humphrey Bogart and Barbara Stanwyck and Betty Davis, and about, you know, life on the set. And one of the things he talked about a lot was how much fun it was, but also how much work it was in those days, in the pre-Screen Actors Guild days. Those stories stuck with me, and that was the basis for the book, that and an incredible supply of scrapbooks that he left behind, because I wrote this book after he had died.
Was he still working in television and in theater?
Yes, when I was growing up, he was. He was. He was somebody who, you know, would have worked till the day he died, and just about did.
What kinds of shows did he appear in?
Well, he did a lot of he continued to do a lot of guest spots on TV. So, you know, ended up at one point playing a 100-year-old man on the Bob Newhart show. That was he was actually younger than 100. But he worked in theater, touring companies, South Pacific at the Lincoln Center, continued to love live theater, actually, and to be, you know, the interaction with an audience.
Although that's not where he got his start. He got his start in the carnival.
He did. Yes, this was really one of the periods that kind of fascinated me as a teenager in the teens of this of the 20th century. He was worked for these touring carnivals that would go throughout the Midwest as a sideshow barker, and then later as a shill in the audience and a magician.
So was this the classic story of the kid who ran away from home and joined the circus or the carnival?
It was, except that he was joining his father, actually, who was himself a touring vaudevillian. His father, who had remarried, and his stepmother, who were you know, players themselves, touring players, troupers.
And then after he left the carnival, he became a hypnotist's assistant.
Yes, that's right.
Learned tricks?
His main job was that he would have rocks broken on his chest. So he was a shill in the audience who would be brought up, and he was supposed to be put into a very deep slumber by the hypnotist. He said he never was successfully hypnotized, but he learned to act. He learned to pretend. And some strong man from the audience would be brought up and, with a sledgehammer, break a rock on his chest, which was, it turned out, a common trick. And my father always said there was nothing to it. But as I researched this book and I found out about this hypnotism craze around that time that was sweeping the country, turns out that was a common trick, but it was also a very dangerous trick, and in fact people died having it done to them.
Well, how did he do something to protect himself?
Well, he claimed that if you were suspended between two chairs, your body would give, and there was enough resilience that would protect you. But, you know, I guess it did enough of the time that he survived to tell the story.
My guest is New Yorker writer Margaret Talbot. She's written a book called The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century. It's published by Riverhead. And then he got his first role in a play.
Yes. So that was his hope and aspiration, and it worked out for him.
But he almost got fired.
Yes, he almost got fired because he was meant to slug somebody who happened to be on stage, an actor who happened to be the head of the company along with his wife. And of course he wasn't meant to really slug him. He was meant to, you know, do a feint in stage combat, and he failed at that and knocked the guy out. And the guy was lying there on the floor bleeding, saying, you know, swearing at him, mumbling under his breath. And he said, you know, that's the end for you, Talbot, you're out. You know, maybe you can stick around and help set up the tent, because these were touring tent shows. But that's all I'm going to guarantee. And then the wife took pity on him and eventually gave him some parts in the play.
And he worked his way to New York.
He worked his way, ended up actually on Broadway much later in the early 40s. But he did act in New York during that time and in other touring companies.
And you call the 1920s the era that gave rise to the first youth culture in the United States. He was part of that?
Yes. A lot of the plays he did were these plays about, flappers and new women and young marriages. There was actually kind of a boom in young marriage at that time, but young people who had some period of independence in their life before. So there were a lot of plays about the difficulty of adjusting to marriage for young people who'd actually seen a little of the world. Some of these plays were plays that were, originally performed in New York, but then they were taken around to these small towns in the Midwest. So they were kind of a way of bringing people in the hinterlands up to date on changing values.
Well, he never turned down a role, but you write that he hid out for a whole week to avoid joining a play that starred Mae West. I would have thought that would have been a thrill.
Yes, the play Sex, subtly named play Sex. Yes, Mae West, this was the play she actually in New York was sent to jail on Governor's Island for a few days. Maybe a week, I'm not sure. But anyway, she served some time in jail for performing it here. But she was trying to get together a revival in Chicago, which I guess at that time was a little more liberal, and strangely enough. And she tried out father
Billy Sunday couldn't shut it down.
That's right. So my father auditioned for the part and actually got the part, but was so overwhelmed by Mae West and kind of intimidated by her sexuality that he snuck out and claimed that he didn't get the call from the agent and that his mother was sick and he had to go home.
Did they meet again after they both wound up in Hollywood?
They did. Many years later, he did a movie with her when he was much more self-assured and less wet behind the ears and less innocent. And it was called Go West, Young Man. And he told her the story and she was very amused by it and said, I don't scare you now, do I? And he said, oh, no, not at all. I think you're marvelous, Miss West.
So he decided that he would go to Hollywood to pursue a career in the movies?
Yes, he, it was actually sort of the classic story. He was at that time doing a play in a theater in Dallas, and, the theater company went belly up. The owner absconded with the money, the last paychecks for all the actors. He did not have a cent. But luckily, a talent scout from Hollywood, it was the time when they were looking for actors with theatrical experience because it was the beginning of talkies. This was 1932, and they were feeling that perhaps this was where you should be trawling for talent. And so they brought him out to Hollywood, luckily, with, not a cent in his pocket, and he had his first screen test. He signed with Warner Brothers, yeah.
Did he know that the scene he performed from Louder, Please! Was a parody of Daryl Zanuck, who was the Warner production chief?
Had no idea. He chose this play because he chose the scene because it was the play he'd been performing in Dallas, and this was a taboo play on the Warner Brothers lot. And the cameraman who filmed the screen test told him this afterwards, and my dad said, "Well, could you film it over again?" He said, "No, I don't have time. There's somebody else waiting." And so my dad thought that was the end. His agent thought that was the end. But Daryl Zanuck, for whatever reason, happened to watch it that day, was kind of amused, and William Wellman, the director, was there, Wild Bill Wellman, and thought it was actually my dad showing incredible chutzpah, and was so impressed with him that he said he wanted him in his next movie, a movie called Love is a Racket. Of course, my father had never meant to do it, but William Wellman would never believe that.
Well, we're talking about William Wellman, one of the greatest directors in Hollywood. He's starting pretty much at the top there.
Right.
And he's starting at a time that we call pre-code Hollywood. How much censorship was there at the time?
Well, at the time, what we call the Hays Code was in effect, but basically producers were ignoring it. They felt they could get away with pushing the boundaries, and at that time they could, until the Catholic Church and other groups successfully organized a boycott of movies, and the studios had to start adhering to this code.
But I've seen a number of those pre-code films, quite a few, and although they just seem a little more adult than the films that followed,
yes,
they are not in any way obscene.
Right. And of course, they're nothing like what we would see today.
No curse words, no nudity.
Right, Right. But they do, they are much more, you know, they're a little bit coarser, a little bit more ribald. And one thing that's really notable about them is they don't necessarily punish wrongdoers at the end of the movie, which was something the code actually called for.
In fact, Barbara Stanwyck became a star playing women who slept their way to the top and then did well at the end.
That's right.
You write about your father, quote, as a young man with an erotic charge to him, he projected a particular combination of tenderness and sensuality and a certain hollowness at its core. Was that hollowness a part of his appeal, do you think?
I think in the end it probably limited him, you know, because one of the things I talk about in the book is why does somebody who was sort of groomed for success and stardom and who seemed like perhaps he could have been on the cusp of it, what was it that, you know, why wasn't he a star? And, you know, I think actually there was a kind of quality he had which was a little shallow and didn't translate. There wasn't enough deep core of passion there in his portrayals.
Did that manifest itself into real life?
In some ways, I think, yes. I think he was somebody who, you know, I mean, I suppose you could say that actors in general are not necessarily the most introspective lot, but he was particularly non-introspective and, you know, a little bit vain and you know, I think in some ways didn't have a really strong moral compass himself. That's what my mom provided.
But he appeared in a lot of films.
He did. He appeared in a lot of films, and he was very hardworking, and he was good-looking, and he had a certain charm, and he is quite good at playing these characters, these kind of weaselly characters in some of the early pre-code movies. He's very, very good at, like, Three on a Match is one of them.
He even had an episode with Clark Gable involving Carol Lombard.
He did, because he, although he dated many beautiful women in Hollywood, Carol Lombard was one he did not date and wanted to. Like a lot of people, really enjoyed that she was, you know, both very beautiful and also this kind of, you know, tough gal with a heart of gold, really was that way and, you know, was profane but kind of kind. So he had a fist fight or threatened fist fight with Clark Gable at one of the Hollywood watering holes over Carol Lombard.
Well, do you think that those kinds of things and then some of the other things that he did played a part in his not really making it, even though he appeared in so many films, and his eventual eventually being forced to leave Hollywood? I mean, he was one of the founders of the Screen Actors Guild. Unionizing couldn't have endeared him to the studio moguls.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually could have played a role because he was one of the original 21 founders of the Screen Actors Guild. And at that time, most of the other founders were older character actors, some of them British actors from the theater. And so there weren't as many of the young leading men types. He was the only one under contract at Warner Brothers at that time. And, you know, the studios were actually sending spies around to the early meetings of the Screen Actors Guild. They would meet in these houses in Beverly Hills that had alleys so the actors could go out the back way and not be seen by studio spies. So the studio did actually take this pretty seriously.
And it was also the time of the House and American Activities Committee and McCarthy. Was your father seen as a leftist?
He really wasn't, because in general he wasn't a leftist. It was really the union activity was for him kind of singular. I think, you know, partly because he came from the theater world where there had been a lot of camaraderie, and this was the early 30s, you know, when SAG was being founded. So he was not one of the sort of lefty Popular Front kind of, you know, sympathizers, but he was, you know, a union advocate strongly.
He served in World War II.
He did, actually, strangely enough, yeah.
So, and then he returned to Hollywood, and what happened?
Yeah, I mean, he served on he served sort of Ronald Reagan-style serving. He served on
Ronald Reagan was in SAG as well.
Yes, exactly, and became president of SAG. But, yeah, he, you know, was on an Air Force base in Merced where he organized entertainment. So, and he always said that, you know, there were a couple of very rural, you know, kids who were there training. And one of them once said when he saw a play that my father had put on, "I've never seen round actors before," because he'd only seen movies. So he'd only seen, you know, flat actors on the screen. And then he returned to Hollywood after that, and that's when the Ed Wood adventure began.
And the end of his movie career, in effect.
Yeah, I mean, he really switched to after, you know, doing some of these B movies and the occasional sort of small part. There's an interesting movie I just watched the other night called The Great Man that was made by Jose Farrar. That's kind of a very interesting sort of sweet smell of success type movie. That's a satiric look at the radio industry, actually, and very well done. Anyway, he has a good part in that. That's a good cast. So he continued to do movies here and there, but mainly switched over to television and shows like Ozzie and Harriet, where he was a regular for many years.
Playing a comic character.
Yeah, playing, you know, the bumbling next-door neighbor who's always in the cardigan sweater, coming over to borrow, you know, Ozzie's golf clubs.
And then he also started working in theater. He almost sounds like a blacklisted actor of that generation, even though politics played no role.
Yeah. Yes and no, because he was never picked up by the studio again at Warner Brothers, but he continued, you know, to act steadily and you know, make a living at it.
He also had a problem with alcohol.
He did.
Did that affect his career?
I think it probably did. A lot of people, of course, had problems with alcohol in Hollywood. And there were people like Busby Berkeley, who was somebody he worked for in one of the non-musicals Busby Berkeley made, who, you know, was in a drunk driving accident where people were killed and he, you know, was prosecuted for it. So, you know, and it didn't actually slow his career down. So I wouldn't want to blame it entirely on that. On the other hand, given other factors, you know, like the fact that he wasn't going to be a star and the fact that he was a SAG organizer, the fact that he kept getting in these drunk driving accidents, my father I'm speaking of now, and had to be, you know, bailed out by the studio, which the studio did, you know, I'm sure was not helpful.
Now, you must have thought very carefully about the title, and you've called this book The Entertainer, not the artist, not the movie star, not the B movie star. Do you think your father wasn't an artist?
I think he was not an artist. I think he was an entertainer, and I say that with great respect, and I think it's something that he had great respect and regard for. He took very seriously the duty to entertain, if you will. And I admire that. You know, when he went out on a stage, you know, he was professional. He was there for the audience, and he believed in that. And he believed in that even in his daily life, so that he was somebody who went out, if he would go to the grocery store, he would dress up beautifully. And, you know, because that was his, you know, in a way, his gift to the world, if you will.
Was it difficult in writing this book to be objective about your father's failures and limitations? And do you think it would have been different if you had been born earlier in his life?
You know, I don't think I could have written this book while he was still alive, because there were certain things I did want to say, judging, you know, him as an actor, as a character, that, you know, I would have worried about hurting him, because, in fact, he was a great dad. You know, in many ways, you wouldn't have expected him to be somebody who had his somewhat checkered past and became a father so late in life, but he actually was a very good one. I have three older siblings, and I know they'd say the same. And I would never have wanted to hurt him, but I would only want to write a book where I felt I could be honest.
Well, though, he died a long time ago.
He died in 1996.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And have you been working on this book ever since?
No. Mostly I've been writing at The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine before that. But I guess I've thought about it ever since, you know, but I haven't. I didn't take that long to write it. I just started late.
Margaret Talbot's book is The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century. It's published by Riverhead Press. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.